I'm not quite sure if the Chinese market will go back to being number one, because it's dropped from one. Last year it was third, and now it's the sixth, maybe seventh largest destination for U.S. agricultural exports, depending on how the world is defined, right? But the point is, it's certainly no longer number one. And we've seen, say, like in the state of Tennessee, export sales to China drop about 80%. Nationally, we've seen export sales to China drop about 60%.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/ag. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Feed Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I am Wilmer Pacheco. I am an extension specialist and associate professor in the Department of Poultry Science at Auburn University. We are dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the feed industry. So get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. And today I have the pleasure of having as a guest Dr. Andrew Mohammed. Dr. Mohammed is an internationally recognized agricultural economist specializing in international trade, commodity markets, and in general, the global competitiveness of the U.S. agriculture. He also serves as a professor and a researcher in at the University of Tennessee. So today we will explore how global trade directly affects feed mills, ingredient suppliers, livestock producers, and the overall competitiveness of U.S. animal agriculture. Hello, Dr. Mohammed. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. And could you, I know that you have been in other podcasts before, but could you please share some insights of your professional experience with our audience?
So yeah, I've been working on international trade issues for about 25 years now. In fact, my dissertation was on the WTO and its implications for U.S. dairy exports, particularly in Asian markets. And so prior to joining the University of Tennessee, which has been about 8 years now, I spent 8 years with the Economic Research Service, which is an agency of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where I worked on trade issues as well as help to manage what's called the Market and Trade Economics Division, where we did things like sort of the world agricultural supply and demand estimates, the situation and outlook type reports that you get from USDA. And so there I worked on trade issues, partly served as an advisor, mainly to the Foreign Agricultural Research Service, where we basically did international trade research to help inform trade agreements and trade positions in trade agreements. And then before that, Mississippi State. And so, and then prior to that, even Southern University. I've had a pretty varied career from 1890 institutions, now at my second sort of major land grant, and as I said, and I spent some time in Washington, D.C. working on trade issues. And that was during both administrations, mostly President Obama, but the tail end of President Trump. And then lastly, I still actually provide some advisory type roles for USDA, and I serve on the Ag Policy Advisory Committee, which is the committee mandated by Congress to provide trade policy advice to the Secretary of Ag in the U.S. Trade Representative Office.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Excellent, excellent. And you know, like, since we are going to be talking about like international trade, I would like to know your thoughts on the Supreme Court ruling regarding tariffs. And how do you think that that will affect international agricultural trade?
And so it looks like the Supreme Court appealed to the Constitution, and the Constitution puts sort of the responsibility of tariffs and taxes in the hands of Congress. And it looks up to this point like Congress was sort of giving their responsibilities over to the executive branch, but the Supreme Court basically ruled to say that, no, if you want to get this type of trade policy done and completed, it needs to be through congressional action. And so what that does is it eliminates not all tariffs, but the Liberation Day tariffs, the tariffs that came under the International Emergencies and Economic Powers Act. And maybe I'm getting economics and emergency sort of mixed up, but IEEPA tariffs. And that was in April when the president decided to have across-the-board tariffs of varying rates on different countries. And unlike some of the other trade acts that require investigation, so say the Unfair Trade Practices Act, Section 301 or Section 292, if I'm not mistaken, which is the National Security Trade Act, those require investigations and it requires Commerce to come up with a ruling. And then from that ruling, it gives the president legal authority to impose tariffs. Well, this is something different. And so and because of that difference, the Supreme Court ruled that these tariffs are in violation of the Constitution. Now, what that does mean, however, is that the president needs to find other ways to impose tariffs. Now, mind you, he did mention another trade act that allows for temporary tariffs, I think, of around 10% for 150 days. And so that I'm not quite sure how that's going to play out. But I think the what's good about this is that it allows for at least more stable trade policy. And it does say that if, say, the Republicans in Congress are in full support of what the president is doing, then they have to sort of make it real through legislative action. And they can't just simply sit back and leave all of these things in the hands of the executive branch.
Okay. And from your perspective, why is international trade critical to the competitiveness of U.S. feed and livestock production?
Yeah, well, it's important across the board, right? One, obviously, it's important just in terms of the revenue it brings into the country. But the first sort of thing I want to highlight is its importance relative to the share of U.S. agricultural production. And that's going to depend. If you get a commodity like cotton, that's going to be 80%. When you think of a lot of our feed grains and you think of oilseed crops, particularly, say, soybeans, corn, wheat, like half of our production tends to go to global markets. So we clearly produce beyond our demand. And then when you get to livestock products, whether it be dairy, pork, or poultry, that tends to be a little more than 10%. But for example, with beef, that 10% is going to be at least $10 billion in export sales, making beef a top five, if not a top 10, if not a top five agricultural export. And so the point is, global demand is particularly important to U.S. competitiveness, that we are surplus producers of primary agriculture. Even though we have a trade deficit now in agricultural trade, so much of that is high value added products like beer, wine, and spirits, and fresh fruits and vegetables and coffee. But when it comes to primary agriculture, we're net exporters and we really do rely on the world for disappearance in sales.
And what do you think that will happen, you know, because if we are not able to export those ingredients, let's say, you know, like soybeans, soybean meal, sorghum, they will have to stay here in the country, right? And we can store those ingredients, but not for too long. So what does that, how does the internal prices change inside?
And so there are two things to consider. So when we impose tariffs on the country, they retaliate. And oftentimes that retaliation is against U.S. agricultural exports. And most notably, that was the case with China this last year. And China is our leading, was at least at one point, sort of our leading buyer of many of these agricultural commodities that we export. And one of the things that they did last year is completely halt sales of soybeans. in which weed took a particularly big hit. Now, mind you, when you have excess supply on the market, it leads to a depression of prices. And we've seen this downward pressure on commodity prices, particularly for soybeans and feed crops. And the point is, a big part of that is because when countries impose trade barriers, it leaves a lot of product on the market. And that extra product, the excess supply, puts downward pressure on prices. And so that's been the impact overall. What's interesting here, though, is the retaliation from China was not necessarily retaliatory tariffs, but retaliation in terms of simply just restricting trade outright. We even saw the same thing for beef, where the Chinese government refused to reinstate licenses for, I think, 400 U.S. beef processors. And we've seen sort of our share of the Chinese market in terms of beef export sales, for example, go from about well over 10 to 15%, maybe even a high of 20 down to 0%. So pretty much negligible trade now. So the point is that these trade actions, particularly when countries retaliate, disrupt both what we're able to export as well as depress prices. And something we're also not considering is the, something that others have considered, I should probably rephrase that, is the fact that we also, our tariffs have also impacted agricultural inputs, whether it be fertilizer, energy, as well as agricultural machinery. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen the increase in fertilizer prices, which actually is now working against the fact that we have sort of low crop prices right now.
Okay. And, you know, like based on the current markets, what would be your advice for like nutritionists and feed mills?
I think the one thing I would say, and this is just not just advice for individual feed mills, but advice for this sector, as well as the broader agricultural sector. And that is that there's something fundamental that's happening in the world that's affecting how competitive U.S. products are in global markets. And that's the rise of Brazil as a major agricultural producer. And increasingly, the U.S. is being displaced by Brazil, and they've invested quite a bit in agricultural production as well as productivity in some of the main crops that we export, most notably, for example, soybeans. And so my advice to sort of any agricultural sector affected by what's going on right now, particularly would decrease export sales to China, it would be that we really do need to invest in finding markets other than China for export disappearance. And we need to create new demand. I'm not quite sure if the Chinese market will go back to being number one, because it's dropped from one. Last year it was third, and now it's the sixth, maybe seventh largest destination for U.S. agricultural exports, depending on how the world is defined, right? But the point is, it's certainly no longer number one. And we've seen, say, like in the state of Tennessee, export sales to China drop about 80%. Nationally, we've seen export sales to China drop about 60%. And that's been sort of part of a longer-term trend where they've become increasingly more reliant on Brazilian export sales. And I think if we're going to move forward and be competitive, we need to think about how to best diversify export sales, particularly to markets other than China.
But like, what those markets will it be like? Will it be like Mexico, Canada, Europe, markets in, let's say, Southeast Asia, other countries, maybe like Thailand, Indonesia?
No, that's a good question. And so one growing area one could argue is Southeast Asia. We've seen some growth in Vietnam, both in terms of their demand capacity, as well as just sort of in their own agricultural production and feed needs, as well as, say, the demand for cotton and manufacturing of textiles, for example. And so we do see increase in demand in Southeast Asia. Obviously, the president just negotiated at least sort of the types of trade agreements he negotiates, sort of these kind of more so like MOUs, but still considered to be agreements. You see this agreement with India, right? One of the largest countries in the world, may have surpassed China in terms of population, but certainly can rival China in terms of population. One of the things I think we should really probably look at is just sort of the developing countries in sub-Saharan Africa, right? Where as the middle class increases there, right? So they're on their upward trend that Asia was once on, particularly in countries like Kenya, Nigeria, Ghana. So I do think there's a need, particularly say for like their aquaculture sector, their poultry sector, as well as their sort of cattle sector, this increase in feed demand. And what that does for us is it also allows for the U.S. to not just export, say, raw soybeans, as it did in the case of China, but also soybean meal, which we do a little bit less of in Asia. But obviously, we could do a lot more in African countries because they have a demand not just for the product itself, but also for that first stage processing.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like I think some of the good news is like, you know, like some of these countries like India, for example, I think the consumption of chicken is still fairly low. I think they consume less than 20 pounds per capita per year. So, you know, I have heard some people that say, well, if they increase just half a pound to a pound extra per year, just because they have over 1 billion people, then they will need more ingredients, so more corn, more soybeans, more soybean meal. But also, probably there will be like an opportunity for exports of chickens and other, you know, like type of meats from the U.S.
No, that's 100% correct. That as sort of economies grow, meat demand increases, and they want to grow their own sector, but the growth in their own sector usually is not at the same pace as the growth in demand. So you do see both an increase in imports of feed as well as an increase in imports of final meat products. And so, yeah, you're 100% correct. Like when countries sort of come from out of this kind of low income, developing country status, diets immediately transition from grains and staples to sort of these livestock products, resulting in both increased demand for meat as well as an increased demand for feed ingredients. So yeah, that you're on point with that.
Yeah, and how do export markets for animal products influence domestic demands for feed grains and co-products? So how does that affect what is going on inside the United States?
Well, I mean, obviously it has sort of two effects. As animal production grows around the world, there's increased demand for feed, and as a particularly efficient and competitive feed supplier, the U.S. is one of the prime places to buy from. Now, one could argue that Brazil is sort of replacing us in that sort of most competitive status. But the point is, I think so much of what's happening now is a function of just uncertainty in trade policy, which we could get to later. But the point is that as the globe sort of consumes more meat and they seek to produce it on their own, it leads to increases in feed demand, which is sort of an obvious relationship. While at the same time, as the world has greater demand for our meat products, it requires that we expand production. And so the hope is that as the world becomes more developed and diets transition, that we may see a turnaround in agricultural prices, as well as we may hopefully sort of see new markets emerge as buyers of both U.S. meat products as well as U.S. feed ingredients. And so I say all that to say that in the end, international trade has this positive impact on our sectors, whether it's indirectly through our own production of animal protein or directly by supplying feed ingredients to production overseas.
And let's say, you know, because I'm curious about this now too, what if we, you know, like in the U.S., we need to change even like the model of production. For example, you were discussing like, you know, like Europe might be like a really good market, but sometimes they have a specific rules. Like, for example, you know, you have to be, I don't know like the specific rule, but non-GMO and other rules. How can we adapt, you know, our production just to comply with the rules of the importing market?
That's a pretty good question. I mean, no, it's an excellent question. And it does say something about sort of how should we proceed as a sector. All right, so there are two routes to go. All right, so the first would simply to be to actually to negotiate sort of legitimate trade agreements And within those agreements, come to some idea about what regulatory equivalency looks like. And then to go to the broader standards of what is, in fact, harmful to human health or animal health, and to really think about the science of GMOs and to get to the bottom of whether or not European countries are just simply using this as an implicit trade barrier. Right? That's the whole point, I think, what a trade agreement would do, where we would not necessarily have to change, but we could come to some agreement with Europe to say, look, clearly this is what we're doing. It's not harmful to human health. And let's come to an agreement on what's acceptable. Now, the other thing is to modify our production process for a particular market. Now, that's more difficult than you would think because we actually do that. So, for example, there are some small producers of, say, hormone-free beef that can qualify for export sales to the EU. But one would call that sort of a niche area of production. Even within the United States, non-GMO production, right, is sort of a niche area. We can invest more in that. But I think the bigger issue would simply be, how do we get countries to come to some agreement such that they're not using sort of GMO policy as an implicit trade barrier? And I often wonder if that's what we're sort of engaging here when we engage the world. But I'll close with this point. One of the things that makes us more efficient, right, is the size and the bigness of what we do. And once you drill down into no sort of niche markets, you need sort of demand that's willing to pay for the extra cost of the unique behavior itself. And I do wonder about European countries, whether they're sort of willing to pay the additional cost of sort of non-GMO production, for example. Now, but the one thing I will say about Europe, I don't think they have outright GMO bans. What they have is just sort of a regulatory framework that makes approval difficult. And so obviously, that's where trade agreements work perfectly, because it's a means by which the approval process could be harmonized and streamlined such that we could get products in the market quicker.
Yeah. And you know what? Another thing that I see more like these days is like life cycle assessments for, you know, like all type of productions, you know, like and looking more like the sustainability part. And that's something that I think, you know, we are ahead compared to any other countries, is that in the U.S., we are able, just because of the technology that we have, we are able to produce soybeans, corn, other grains are more sustainable compared to other countries. So that might be like something that is going to play in our favors, in our favor in years to come.
No, I agree. I agree 100%. And like I said, it's always a matter of, one, the promotion of sustainability as sort of an aspect of what consumers demand. And it's also a willingness on the part of consumers to pay for it. But what we're able to do is to be more sustainable and still relatively inexpensive compared to other global producers. And I think that is an advantage for the United States.
Yeah. And you know, like this is, how can I say, things change from one day to the other. So what trade-related risks should the feed industry professionals be monitoring over the next few years?
Yeah, no, that's actually a pretty difficult question, right? Because we've been in this era of just uncertain trade policy. And trade policy uncertainty, as measured by sort of people who create these indices of uncertainty, reached record levels in 2025. I mean, maybe 10, if not 20 times the level it reached in 2018 during the previous trade war. And so I know it's difficult when you have uncertain trade policy and it's kind of on again, off again tariffs, to have sort of consistent business relationships with countries globally. It's particularly difficult. It's also difficult to think about how does one invest in that type of environment, right? Do you expand capacity here? Do you expand capacity abroad? And this uncertainty says just park your money on the sideline until things become more stable. And so one of the things I do sort of worry when we sort of have these on again, off again tariffs is the fact that it just sort of creates uncertainty and added risk that no one can effectively manage. All right. So that's the first point I'd say there. I'm not quite sure how firms would sort of manage just uncertain trade policy. Now, the second thing in terms of risk, obviously, is the downside price risk to sort of a decrease in future demand. And that, I will say, you'd have to sort of reach out to other experts. But the point is, it may take some time to find markets other than China for our export sales moving forward, which means we may be in a period where these relatively low prices may last a little longer than we would like them to last. And so how do we manage low prices in this intermediate run, I really do think is going to be important. Now, clearly, as the global market shakes out and one never knows sort of what's the full production capacity of Brazil, but it's real hard to compete, I'll admit, with triple cropping systems, for example, like you get in South America. But the point is that at some point, when global demand settles and we create these new markets, it's going to then drive up prices once again. But really, what we're going to be in a period of how do we manage low prices such that we stay in business. And what I would sort of caution against is being overly excited for these kind of one-off deals where the White House is able to get country X to buy a certain amount of corn, or countrywide to buy a certain amount of soybeans. These are temporary fixes. What the industry should push for, in my opinion, is more stable trade policy in a more certain environment such that these business-to-business engagements could sort of happen without the risk of some price or cost dynamic changing due to tariffs changing before shipments take place, but after the contract is signed.
Yeah, excellent. And, you know, like we are almost getting done to the time, but we have been focused a lot on things that are leaving the U.S., you know, like grains, soybeans, you know, cereal grains and protein meals. But in terms of national security, there are a lot of things that we don't produce, you know, that we are using in animal feeds like vitamins. What do you think that should be like the role of the United States to increase, you know, national security and maybe be able to produce a lot of those vitamins here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I will say this. I'm a little cautious when it comes to sort of national security arguments for the protection of vital sectors and industries. One, just in principle, if it's right for us to do it, then it's right for other countries to do it. And then at what point do we sort of reach this limit of everything becomes national security, right? The Commerce Department just decided imported wood products is a threat to national security. No one needs to necessarily explain why sort of a wooden kitchen cabinet from Vietnam is a threat to national security. We just simply need to say that it is. And the investigation sort of shakes out accordingly and allows us to protect our domestic sectors. We have to be careful because we are sort of competing in a world where they could do the same thing. And obviously in the instances when it affects us in our exports, we wouldn't necessarily consider it fair. Now, the other thing I'll say that why we have to necessarily be careful with national security arguments. National security arguments as it relates to the globe and the world not being able to supply our needs is one thing altogether. That simply says we need to invest in domestic capacity to increase production, even if the government needs to in some way implicitly subsidize it, that we have a need that the world can't satisfy. That's one thing. It's a very different thing altogether to say we have a need that the world has been able to satisfy and then some, but we just simply want to do it here because we're afraid, right, that they may hold this against us. And one, we're talking about sectors too small to have any kind of leverage in geopolitical relations anyway. But the other thing that's most important here is that rarely do you get trade geopolitical tensions in the sense of actual wars and true national security concerns with countries that have open borders with each other, right? So rarely do you get that. And here's the last thing I'll highlight, and I think we often forget this, and that is imports are not simply sort of products that I buy or you buy directly from a business, right? Imports are imported by actual importing firms and businesses, and they make money sort of in the middle of that transaction. They make money facilitating these purchases on our behalf, right? And so when you decide you want to restrict trade in the name of the domestic sector, you actually do have an ill effect and negative impact on the importing firms that provided those products to the U.S. And there's a lot of economic activity associated with importing. And the most notable example of this would be, you know, particularly national security case, is sort of the tariffs we currently have on aluminum and steel. That was a function of sort of restricting imports in the name of national security. And one of the things that happened is that we saw increases in the prices of products that use steel, the increase in production costs for companies that use steel as a primary input, like, say, Whirlpool and the maker of like dryers and wash machines. And then you also see job losses in those sectors that use steel. You create some jobs in the industry that uses the that makes the product, but you actually lose jobs in the industries that use the product. And so, so if we have shortages, then clearly we need to think about those shortages. But I do caution us when we sort of impose national security type trade policies simply out of fear that a country sort of is controlling too much of our market.
Yeah, and I will agree with you, like with the prices of steel. We have seen an increase because, you know, feed mills, they use a lot of steel. So you can see like an increase, you know, like in the price to build a feed mill. I think Eastley has increased more than 30% since prior to COVID. So, yeah, I fully agree with that. And so just to finish up, if you could give one piece of advice to feed mill managers and maybe like nutritionists, people buying ingredients, about international trade, what would that advice be?
I think I already mentioned this, and I think my advice would be, let's look to the future, that it's going to be different, whether or not we could regain a primary market like we once had. China, I'm not certain. Maybe we can, maybe we can't. But let's look for innovative products and innovative ways to supply the world with competitive sort of agricultural output from the United States. And I think that would be the advice. Let's make full use of export promotion policies, export promotion funding from USDA, as producer groups are already doing. So you like the U.S. Soybean Export Council or the American Soybean Association or other feed grain groups, that let's continue to try to increase demand in competitiveness and promotion in other foreign markets, such that we'll never find ourselves in this position where one country could wreak such havoc on U.S. agriculture.
Well, that's an excellent advice. And as I was telling you before we started the recording, I do like to promote, you know, like the U.S., the usage of U.S. products in international markets. Last week, I was in Colombia visiting the largest milk producer. And while we were, I was basically just looking all the feed mill, checking the operations and helping them to produce more using a DDGS from the United States. But sometimes, you know, like we go like to Europe and help you know, to promote the usage of sorghum from the U.S. because we know like a lot of that sorghum used to go to Asia before. But yeah, that's a really good advice, Dr. Muhammad. So that concludes another episode of the Feed Science Podcast Show presented by Wise Genetics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episodes, please leave us a comment. Thanks again, Dr. Muhammad. And thanks, everyone. Thanks, everyone else. And have a blessed day.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.